freedom of speech.
Our dangers and our opportunities.
This is our challenge, and this is our time.
It really is a revolution.
The public needs to understand how this allegation can wind you up in a court of law, can wind you up with silver wrist bracelets around your wrists, can extinguish your children from yourself in a New York minute.
In the first part of this episode, we learned about parental alienation as a form of child abuse. Today, we will sit down with Dean Tong, an American author, public speaker, consultant, and trial expert in the field of false child abuse allegations. He has consulted for high-profile cases such as that of JonBenet Ramsey and Michael Jackson. We will learn about how false allegations and false memories are real, and their legal implications, as well as how Dean got involved in this field in the first place.
Episode 3, Part 2.
So I work as an expert and have been providing expert services in the field of false child abuse allegations and high conflict custody cases since 2001. And I work in two capacities. I'm a forensic trial consultant or consulting expert, basically assisting attorneys all the way from intake to direct and cross and redirect and recross at trial. And I also provide expert testimony in about 5 to 6 years of psychology and social science.
What are false allegations and false memories?
There are different classifications to allegations. You have false, which is in bad faith, premeditated, with malice aforethought. In other words, somebody is going to pick up a phone and call a toll-free hotline and ruin your life in a New York minute, and they know they're going to do it ahead of time, or they're going to coach their kid before the kid goes to the forensic interview at the Child Advocacy Center on DVD to wrongly accuse you of incest or whatever. That would be a false allegation where somebody knew beforehand who had motive, method, or opportunity to falsely accuse you. Most of the cases are not those. Okay, those are malicious lies. Those cases comprise about 5% of all cases. So maybe 1 in 20 are false allegations. And in fact, you'll hardly even see that nomenclature, that word, false, in the CPS policy and procedure manual in any state. And I've worked cases from all 50 states, so I'm a national guy. Most of the cases are unfounded, unsubstantiated, where they will tell you that, we just couldn't prove the allegation. We couldn't prove it by a preponderance of evidence, more evidence than not, which is 51%, so therefore we're going to unsubstantiate it. Of course, in the same breath, they're going to tell you that doesn't mean it didn't happen. That's their ideology, okay? When you're accused of doing something, clearly it's black or white. You either did it or you didn't do it. There's no gray area. There's no maybe, okay? Unfortunately, this country, we have different courts, and those courts have different levels and burdens of proof. Family court, juvenile court, injunction court, administrative court, where they can put your name on a child abuse registry. It's all preponderance of evidence, 51%. Criminal court, it's evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, 95%, 44% jump. The middle in between is the clear and convincing standard. 75% is what the government needs, CPS, to terminate your parental rights in juvenile court. Okay. And so it's real easy for a court to err on the side of caution, make a mistake on the side of the kid, because of the mindset and mantra and maxim, children don't lie, children are not mistaken about abuse and especially sexual abuse. They must be believed and protected at all costs. Very easy for a judge, a trier and finder of fact, to make that mistake on the side of caution, because the judge will be believing in his own heart of hearts or her own heart of hearts, I did the right thing. Of course, that judge is not educated to the iatrogenic inimical effects of false allegations and the deleterious harm upon the non-abused child who's been treated as if she or he has been truly abused. I'm one of the few guys in America that have the data on that. Studies that go back to 1994 that judges and lawyers have never even seen before. So a false memory would occur when the accuser in his or her prefrontal cortex, amygdala, hippocampus of the right brain, there would be the formation of a false belief system. When that false belief system turns into a false memory and he or she believes in her heart of hearts that it happened, regardless of what the authorities say, the government says, a judge says, professionals say in the case that it didn't happen, it's unsubstantiated, unfounded, or false, but that accuser still believes it, that false memory can turn into a delusion. You can't fix that. You can't cure that. And that's where it's really pathological. Do children fall victim to false memories? Sure, they can, but most young children fall victim to the mere suggestibility, the vulnerability and susceptibility of putting words and thoughts and ideas into their mind. If the little kid can talk about the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, Peter Pan, or the Easter Bunny, he or she can talk about how Daddy touched me in my pee-pee. It happens all the time. There was a case I was consulting on way back in 2000 in Daytona Beach, and the little four-year-old girl said that to the authorities that my daddy put his pee-pee on my pee-pee. Of course, Daddy was arrested because the perception, the belief system was genital on genital contact. That's not what the little girl meant. After a forensic linguist was hired onto the case, it was gleaned that what the little girl meant was that Daddy urinated on top of the little girl's urine in the commode she forgot to flush. These are the errors that I see in cases, in live cases, and the mistakes that are seen, professional negligence, okay? And a lot of it stems from confirmatory bias. Confirmatory bias, confirmation bias in psychology, by very definition, is a preconceived notion. You have a preconceived notion to your opinion, perhaps based on your ideology and belief system, perhaps because the allegations are so heinous and reprehensible, you just believe they happen. So you can't be objective, you can't be independent, you can't be neutral, you can't be impartial. But, you know, memory is encoded, stored, retrieved, and reported. When memory is working correctly, it works reconstructively and involuntarily, okay, automatic. But a lot of things can, you know, corrupt and disrupt memory over time. Memory is not a perfect videotape. It deteriorates with the passage of time. So whether you're raped, you know, or touched inappropriately, whether you're shot in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, unless you have a photographic memory, you're not going to remember the entire trauma. You're going to remember bits and pieces of that trauma. That's called GIST, G-I-S-T memory. Most people are going to have that. They're not going to have what's called verbatim memory, where you're going to remember the entire event.
Can false allegations and false memories be used as legal weapons to gain control?
Do these allegations, you know, can they be used as a weapon? Well, sure. I mean, there's a whole chapter in my book, Elusive Innocence, on the SED syndrome, sexual allegations of divorce, where accusers can have motive, method, opportunity to wield the child as a pawn, weapon, or tool for the purpose of gaining custody, child support, social status as the most fit parent, you know, whatever agenda, whatever other agenda they want to have, whether that's to effect, as I say in my book, a fatherectomy and eviscerate the father from the child's life and vice versa. This is the nuclear weapon. This is the atomic bomb. This is the ultimate trump card because it's the one that's going to raise the eyebrows off of the forehead of the trier and finder of fact, the judge.
Are there different types of accusers?
Yeah. So this was first published by psychologist Blush and Ross out of Michigan in 1987, about 30 years ago. And they profiled the false accuser as being the psychotic, which are very few people. You know, the person who would have a profile who would typify as a criminal psychopath, very few would profile out to be that type of person. But most fall into the other two categories, which are the justified vindicator, which is just a vindictive individual who has an axe to grind, who's vengeful and who's going to, you know, get you. This is the way, you know, he or she has figured out how to do so. And then there's the hysterical personality type, which is the undiagnosed, untreated, you know, DSM-5 mental health personality disorder, whether it's borderline, narcissistic, histrionic, combination perhaps of all three, paranoid, delusional, you know, but unfortunately, in these cases, because as I say at my website, abuseexcuse.com, in my book, Elusive Innocence, you're presumed guilty, and you have to prove a negative to prove you're innocent. The accuser doesn't have to usually go through any psychological evaluations or polygraphs or psychosexual risk assessment testing like the accused does. It's very tilted very quickly. These allegations are so weighted against the accused.
So what are the legal implications of false allegations?
The public needs to understand how this allegation can wind you up in a court of law, can wind you up with silver wrist bracelets around your wrists, can, you know, extinguish your children from yourself in a New York minute. You got to understand hearsay And hearsay is an extrajudicial statement. It's a statement made outside of court. And generally speaking, hearsay is legally inadmissible because it is a statement made for the truth of the matter asserted. This is the exception to the hearsay rule, Rule 803. And that's why this is so powerful, because there doesn't need to be forensics. This is he said, she said, what a child said. And that's all that's necessary to put you behind life in prison, behind bars, and lifelong sex offender registration is this atomic bomb.
Wow, so this hearsay issue seems to be a real problem, right?
The hearsay issue is a huge issue that needs to be tackled by law professors and criminal justice professors and experts need to articulate how we can fix this hearsay rule thing. That needs to be tightened up, because it's just too easy to lose your freedom and your family due to hearsay.
Are there any flaws in the legal system?
Well, yeah, I already described one, the preponderance of evidence standard. When I ran for politics in 94, it was 25 years ago in Florida, one of my attempts was to influence the Judiciary Committee to increase the standard of proof to clear and convincing across the board. It's too easy. It's too easy for a judge to use his or her subjective discretion when he or her only has to rule by 51% preponderance of evidence that abuse happened or it didn't, that somebody's credible versus somebody isn't in a credibility shootout, he said, she said, and where a judge can make a mistake and err on the side of caution. So I think, and of course the lobbyists and the attorneys don't want that burden of proof increased, because that makes it more difficult, makes it much more difficult to prove your case if you elevate that to 75% clear and convincing. But the other things, of course, we have to look at are the federal laws. You're not going to fix state law until you first repair, federal law. And that would be the CAPTA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, also known as the Mondale Act from 1974. You know, that law created basically CPS. It created anonymity. You can call toll free and be anonymous and ruin somebody's life in a New York minute. So that law has got to be looked at, CAPTA, very closely. VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, 1994, 20 years later, authored by, former Vice President Joe Biden. That was part of Clinton's National Crime Act. That law gave the power to all the states to create these orders for protection from abuse, where an accuser just needs a statement of fear, threatened bodily harm, in an affidavit. That's it. That's it. And you're out of your domicile. You can't come within 300 or 500 feet of your house or the complainant or your children. And then you've got ASFA, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was Clinton's baby in 1997. Which makes it very easy and quick to terminate a parent's rights. Within 1 year, you can lose your parental rights to your children. 12 to 15 months is the time frame under ASPA, the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And then, of course, you've got Title 4D&E of the Social Security Act, which, of course, that supplies all the money to the system. So this is a huge, huge industry, establishment, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you've got obviously child protective investigators and forensic interviewers and sexual abuse nurse examiners, and you've got therapists, and you have attorneys and judges and guardians ad litem. I mean, there's just all kinds of fiduciaries and professionals that come to the aid of the purportedly abused child to assist the court. So it's a huge, huge system, not only in numbers of professionals, but money. So, Dr. Ralph Underwager, who wrote the foreword to my first book, which was published in 1992, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, said in the foreword, if you took the profit away from the problem, the solution would go a long way towards correcting itself. And he's spot on. He's spot on, because everybody's making money at the expense of our kids. And you also must know that this system works what's called in loco parentis, the state as the parent. So, going back to Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village, and the formation of her law, the evolution of her creation, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, she thinks, that basically the government makes a better parent to our kids than we do.
Is there a correlation to false allegations and parental alienation?
It's basically by proxy. That's how I refer to it. So in other words, if you're falsely accusing a father or a mother, say a father of sexual abuse of his daughter, or a mother of coaching to falsely accuse a father of sexual abuse. So a lot of judges now believe mothers are falsely accusing fathers of sexual abuse by coaching the kids to implicate the fathers. Whatever the case may be, if it turns out to be a false allegation or unfounded allegation, then by proxy, it's parental alienation. So you don't need direct denigration, vilification, or berating or disparagement by one parent against the other parent with the kid in the middle. You don't need that. You can have parental alienation just based on what I just said, a false abuse allegation. Because by definition, of course, that's mental, emotional, psychological abuse. Because the parent, you know, basically who's engineering the false allegation is training, you know, educating the entire family that the other parent is an abuser or the other guardian is an abuser. So that person's a bad guy. You don't have to say he's a jerk or tell your kid he's a jerk in the middle of just conversing in the kitchen or whatever to make it parental alienation. The false allegation is in and of itself a form of parental alienation, absolutely.
How did you first get into this field?
I was accused of molesting my 3-year-old daughter in 1985 out of a bitter divorce and custody battle. I was arrested for the same in the state of Florida, facing 25 years to life imprisonment upon a conviction. The criminal case lasted about 15 months to the latter part of 1986, where the state finally no-filed, meaning I was arrested for probable cause based on what my daughter, who was 3 at the time, allegedly told child protective investigators, but they never filed formal charges against me. The DA's office never brought an indictment or information against me. In Florida, it would have been what's called an information. That never happened. So I just took this to another level. I basically made it my life calling because the bitter divorce and custody battle and the false allegations all interrupted my medical school career. I was accepted into medical school in 1983, and the entire fiasco interrupted my medical program and my career there. And I just decided to start doing research on this issue. And basically, after the false allegations, the criminal charges were dropped, I incurred a supervised chaperone visitation in Florida that lasted 5 years. My case, you know, lasted 10 years in litigation. Didn't end until 1994 because I sued the state of Florida, CPS, Child Protective Services, for $2 million and other professionals for professional negligence. I didn't win the lawsuit, but I had them in court for 4 years. And then I ran for politics. I should back up a little bit. I published my first book, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, in 1992. I ran for politics, state house representative in Jacksonville, on this very platform, on this issue, in a grassroots movement in 1994. And I got the largest write-in candidate vote as an independent in Jacksonville, Florida history, 6%. And of course, while I had no illusion of winning, I did put this issue on the forefront table and forced the incumbent to address the issue and successfully got a couple of laws, 3 laws, in fact, passed within the 90s, changed to my liking within the child protection atmosphere down here in Florida. From there, I published a few more books, and I went on to get my master's degree in 2006 and also have the peer-reviewed scientific journal article to my name. You got to remember, when I got involved in this in the mid-80s, there was the fruition of witch hunt child sex daycare cases all across America. It started in California with McMartin, and then there was the We Care Kelly Michaels case in New Jersey. There was Little Rascals in North Carolina, and the Fells Acre case in Malden, Massachusetts. So there was a bunch of these suggestibility, false memory, if you will, cases throughout America, and we didn't have proper science and law and studies back when I was going through this in the mid-80s. And of course, not to mention, we didn't have computers and Google and internet and iPhones and iPods and iPads. We had none of that. So it wasn't easy to be able to babysit an attorney who's not trained in law school in this very complex niche area of law and psychology and social science. And so I have one of the largest bodies of information on this topic on the planet, both online and offline, because I've been in the field now for 34 years.
What are common mistakes for people who are falsely accused?
The biggest mistake is, you know, the choice of an attorney. There's a section at my website, abuseexcuse.com, how to choose your attorney. So the most important red flag for any legal consumer who is been hit with an abuse allegation, whether, you know, the police are coming to the door or CPS has left their calling card at your front door, or, you know, or you were tipped off that a teacher called in a report against you at school, is your choice of an attorney. Usually my services are secondary, you know, because obviously when it's so early in the case, you're not going to get what's called discovery so quickly anyway, which are the legal, you know, the legal documents and intake reports in the case. Most lawyers are not trained to litigate and try these cases in law school. You have to know that. Okay, I've worked cases from all 50 states, so I'm a ubiquitous, pervasive guy, national guy. I have contacts in all 50 states. With that said, you know, you have to know what type of court you're going to be litigating in. There are several. You know, you've got injunction, restraining order court. You have family, juvenile, criminal, administrative. You may have an administrative case where they put your name on a child abuse registry blacklist. That's an administrative law case where you're going to go up against a CPS hearing officer or magistrate. So, you know, you have to know what kind of attorney you're searching for to make sure that lawyer can practice in that type of litigation field. You know, and, you know, you really don't want a generalist lawyer, a lawyer who does, you know, DUI and bankruptcy and wills and probate and some family law and may have litigated one or two or three child sex cases in their life. Probably the wrong lawyer. You know, and they'll gladly take your retainer check. Trust me. So it's a battle with me, because part of my work as I'm vetting the case and vetting the hearsay and vetting the everybody's work and holding everybody to evidence-based best practices is I'm babysitting the client's attorney. I'm babysitting the attorney I'm working for. And it's unfortunate, but it's a necessary evil. Lawyers don't like to be babysat. They have, you know, very high egos. And, you know, perhaps that's understandable, but there's just too much hanging in the balance. Somebody's freedom, somebody's family, somebody's assets, just too much. So there has to be a team effort here. You know, I can be the first call or I can be the second call. But if I'm the second call, you better make sure that you got the right lawyer. And if your case is going to progress to the necessary need of expert services, where perhaps I have to impeach the credibility of a child protective services worker, a police officer, sex crime detective, forensic interviewer, therapist, you better know that the lawyer will work with Dean Tong. You know, and that's not a maybe. That, you know, that there has to be a marriage there. There just aren't a lot of people that do what I do, whether they're psychologists, psychiatrists, whoever is out there in the country. They're just, you know, I don't have a lot of competition in what I do. And it's interesting because when I'm on the stand on the cross-examination, I'm always asked, you know, have I testified for the state? Well, the state has the people I just mentioned. Why do they need me? My website's north of 1 million hits. I've consulted with 20,000 people or more since 1990 over the past almost 30 years in this field. Those numbers are not exaggerated. Those are real numbers. So obviously I'm a busy guy and I can't help everybody. So I'm a defense guy. But being a defense guy, I also represent mothers and women who have been falsely accused of like coaching or Munchausen syndrome by proxy, who lose their custody of their children. And I also drop cases when men accused of sexual abuse flunk the risk assessment psychosexual testing I put them through. So, you know, with me, you're going to go through testing. You know, I don't care what the attorney says. You know, I really don't care what the lawyer says. I'm an expert. That person is just a lawyer. The lawyer can file motions and petitions and argue the case in a court of law, and that's where it starts and stops. I can get on the stand and testify to a reasonable degree of psychological and scientific certainty. So, again, this is how you get to the Super Bowl and win the Super Bowl. You work as a team. It's not just Tom Brady. It's a team. While the attorney is the quarterback, the attorney has to know that he or she needs help.
So it sounds like the sooner someone realizes they've been falsely accused, the better.
I mean, I win most of my cases that I help on. And I mean, my success rate is north of 90%. With all that said, if you hire me on, you know, 6 weeks before trial, the Titanic's already hit the iceberg. I might not be able to help fix it. So, you know, I always am against playing the let's wait and see what happens game. I'm just against that. I mean, I'm a proactive guy, unconventional guy, thinking outside the box guy. I do stuff that most lawyers don't even think about doing. And I'm vetting the attorney for errors of commission, errors of omission, what he or she may have done wrong or what he or she may not have done at all. And so, it's a situation where these cases can morph out of control very quickly when the government's involved. Trust me, whether it's the state and the DA's office or Child Protective Services or both. Some of my cases are, like I say in Chapter 14 of my book, the three-ring circus. You can be in juvenile, family, and criminal court at the same time. It's what I call the three-ring circus. They can morph out of control, and they can bankrupt you very quickly. And, of course, your attorney, your lawyer, is always going to be your most expensive fee, always, always, always.
So where do you see this going, this culture of outrage and bleed the victim without evidence?
Where do I see it going? I don't see the brakes being pressed anytime soon. You know, it's like a freight train out of control. Vetting the hearsay is what I'm getting at. You know, you have to consider alternative hypotheses. So what are alternative hypotheses? Well, an alternative hypothesis is that it may not have happened, or maybe it happened, but you got the wrong guy, mistaken identity, or maybe it didn't happen at all. Maybe it's a fantasy. Maybe you were in dream therapy, art therapy, you had hypnosis, you were injected with the drug sodium amytal, which is the drug Michael Jackson's first accuser, Jordan Chandler, was drugged with back in 93 when Michael was first accused. Sodium amytal is a drug known to induce false memories. So you have to be open-minded and be, you know, able to look at alternative hypotheses. What else could this be? You have to challenge the victim's story. You can't accept it verbatim as being the truth. So when I get hired onto a case, while I can't believe the child accuser against my client, I can't believe my client either, which is why I put him through testing.
We really appreciate your time, Dean. Are there any related topics you'd like to speak to?
Well, other than the fact that I don't just take child sex cases, even though that's my expertise, which is critiquing and impeaching forensic interviewers across America. And by the way, your audience should know that these forensic interviewers who take the kids to the local CAC for interviews on DVD, in a Q&A between interviewer and child interviewee, they are trained at nationalcac.org, nationalcac.org. That's in Huntsville, Alabama. That's where all these people are professionally trained. That's a one-week training course, and they become a certified forensic interviewer. And all of a sudden, they're doing thousands of forensic interviews. And remember what I said, all that's necessary is hearsay. Words from the mouths of babes is enough to put you behind bars, is enough to make you register as a sex offender for life. But beyond that is, you know, I handle cases of physical child abuse allegations, Munchausen by proxy, which is now known as pediatric falsification condition in the DSM-5. It's also known as malingering or factitious disorder. I also handle domestic violence allegations, whether you've been arrested criminally or you're facing an order for protection. You know, in my state, it's called the DVI here in Florida. You know, in Massachusetts, it's a 209A. In Pennsylvania and Alabama, it's a PFA. It has different acronyms, but it all means the same thing. Domestic violence injunction, a statement of fear, threatened bodily harm. That's all that's necessary to get a judge to sign off on that baby. And you're out of your house. You're away from your kids. It's basically a no contact order. So I handle those cases. Child neglect. I handle those cases. Failure to thrive. I handle those cases where little 2 or 3 year olds or babies are not gaining weight. And the government blames the parent as being medically incompetent and the reason that the kid's losing weight and takes the kid away. Failure to protect. So if you have a girlfriend, your girlfriend's accused of physical abuse and you're at work, you're going to go down for failure to protect because it's your kid and you left the kid being supervised by the girlfriend. So, you know, it happened basically on the girlfriend's watch, but it was your kid. So you go down by proxy. So I handle all those cases. And, make no mistake, this is a child protection system first. It's a family reunification system second.